It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore new AI breakthroughs, what's possible in artificial intelligence and machine learning that could transform numerous professions. But this AI boom comes at a time when tech companies are laying off tens of thousands of workers. Call in with your questions about artificial intelligence. Share how AI is transforming your industry, what makes you thrilled, what makes you petrified. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rebecca Willett is Faculty Director of AI at the University of Chicago's Data Science Institute and a professor of statistics and computer science. Rebecca, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be talking with you this morning.
Well, let's start with the darling of AI now that's making writers like myself shake in our boots. This AI writing program where, you know, that literally writes anything. Can you acquaint us with the demand in the market for AI chat GPT?
Yeah, ChatGPT is a fascinating tool. As you said, people can basically enter in prompts and it will automatically generate text that you can then use to inspire your own writing or maybe in a more pessimistic sense, take shortcuts. And these are basically based on models that were trained using all kinds of text gleaned from the internet, just, you know, unfathomable amounts of data. And so it does have a lot of exciting implications that we don't totally understand. For instance, in education, it's opening up a lot of big questions about, well, what's the best way to, for instance, test and evaluate students when they have tools like ChatGPT at their disposal?
Right, because it's like so disruptive. If a teacher wants an essay on, you know, climate change, and you have this tool that spits out in less than a minute a climate change essay, what is that teacher to do?
Yeah, I think that's correct. But, you know, at the same time, we should keep in mind that these tools are trained using, like I said, data gleaned from all over the internet. And so to some extent, I think that the text that comes out of these tools can be a little bit mainstream or a little of the middle of the road. And so it doesn't always represent the deepest insights or the sparks of creativity that lead to truly great writing. And so I think perhaps we can think about tools like GPT as, you know, a helpful tool, not something to replace writers, but something that might help, you know, trigger new ideas or at least help overcome some initial writer's block. Or be used for more mundane
block,
tasks.
What's that, right?
I've never felt it.
But, you know, I mean, it makes you wonder, like, how could software capture all the nuance of grammar and know all the idioms that I do and understand context and when to use humor? I mean, it really brings up, how can powerful computers capture language like we do?
I agree. And I think that's an area where there's still a lot of kind of fundamental and foundational work to be done by researchers at universities like the University of Chicago or the University of Wisconsin, where we have developed tools that seem to be doing remarkable things. But there's a lot that we don't understand on a fundamental level about how and why they work. When you run this tool, you have to put in a prompt like, oh, please generate for me text that corresponds to, a job search ad for an administrative assistant. And then I would get something back and maybe it's not exactly what I am looking for. And so I need to tweak that input to the tool until I get what I want. And we understand very little about, you know, exactly what the right way to do that is. And so there's still a lot of human intervention required. In addition, there's a lot of things that we don't understand about implicit biases that are appearing inside these tools. So you can run it in safe mode so that it doesn't do things that are using, I don't know, explicitly racist terms, for instance, which is good. But there are other kinds of hidden, more nuanced forms of bias that are present inside these tools that researchers are struggling to figure out how to guard against. And in addition, you know, these tools are, like I said, somewhat generalist. And you could imagine saying, well, I'd really like to train something like ChatGPT for a much more specialized purpose. But of course, I've got much less data in that context. And so how can we make these tools work, or how can we train them when we've got much smaller quantities of data that I want to use in a specialized setting? So this, you know, it's an intriguing tool, but I would say we're far from thinking of this as a solved problem. And there's a lot of interesting research and still to be done.
Rebecca Willett with us, Faculty Director of AI at the University of Chicago's Data Science Institute. You can join in on artificial intelligence and machine learning, how you see it impacting your life, your industry, 800-642-1234. You know, moving now to healthcare and how, you know, chatbots and other things could impact healthcare providers, or how AI could improve care for patients. Can you give us some examples there?
This is something where there's still ongoing investigations. So more generally, I think AI is being used inside healthcare settings. But, you know, it's very context dependent. So one area that I work in, for instance, is in medical imaging, where you go in for an MRI or a CAT scan, and the data that's coming off the machine is very different than the image that your radiologist is looking at. And so we need to use computational tools to take that raw data and transform it into a useful image. And one of the things that the community has been investigating recently is how to use tools from AI and machine learning to make that process faster and more accurate. And so that's something where we have a really strong understanding of many of the different challenges involved. And we also have known mechanisms for evaluating the quality of different methods. So at the other end of the spectrum, the people have suggested, could we use, you know, AI-trained chatbots to deliver therapy to people, you know, like mental health support? And there, I think it's much less clear what the risks are or where the challenges lie. It's even harder to evaluate efficacy. We can't just assign a number to, you know, how accurate or how helpful a AI therapist would be. It requires us to test on humans. And of course, we don't want to test a potentially deeply flawed therapist on a human. And so developing these tools, things like chatbots for medical care, is, you know, can be significantly more challenging and requires a lot of testing.
I want to just level set here for a moment. Are there problems that AI can now solve well, like solve effectively? What does AI do well now?
So broadly speaking, I think two poster children for AI are in image recognition and computer vision, and in natural language processing. So computer vision would be things like, you know, being able to take an image and figure out what's in it. Like there's a dog in front of a house and maybe a sprinkler is running or something. And, you know, for the AI system to do that automatically. And natural language processing would be, it would include things like large language models like ChatGPT, but also things like, you know, if you've got something like Alexa, where you speak and it automatically listens to your voice, transcribes that into text, interprets that text, and then conducts an action. So these are areas where AI has really made huge strides in recent times. And there's a lot of interest in trying to figure out how to leverage those successes in other settings like healthcare. So one thing, for instance, where we're seeing some successes is in trying to build tools that can assist a radiologist who's looking at, say, an MRI or a PET scan or a CT scan and looking for tumors or lesions. And so you'd like to be able to use AI to point out areas that a radiologist might want to give particular attention to that they might have otherwise overlooked.
The computer doing kind of the cursory work and the radiologist doing the deeper dive into particular areas that really need more human specialized eyeball attention.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we're not really talking at this point about putting radiologists out of work. It's really more about developing tools that'll just help them out and hopefully just limit the number of false alarms and also limit the number of misses. And I know that some of these tools are currently being studied with, you know, large clinical trials for FDA approval. And so it could be that in the coming years, you'll actually like have your radiologist be using some of these tools.
Statistician and computer scientist Rebecca Willett is faculty director of AI at the University of Chicago's Data Science Institute. Colin, about what you wondered with new breakthroughs like the chatbot and how you experience AI in your personal life. Bring your questions, your comments about powerful computing, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. AI-enabled devices, they are all around us. We learn about the AI research boom, what's possible. What does artificial intelligence mean for your job security? Could a computer one day do your work, or is it doing some element of it now? Call in with your questions about AI. Share how artificial intelligence is affecting your life and work, 800-642-1234. We have Rebecca Willett, professor of statistics and computer science at the University of Chicago. Let's go to Chris in Port Wing. Hi, Chris. What would you like to add?
Good morning. I just wanted to alert people to a great book called The Age of AI and Our Human Future, written by Henry Kissinger and Eric Schmidt and Daniel Huttenlocher. It's a very good analysis of the current developments of AI, and it's a plea to get people to take up a cultural discussion about the cultural and social impacts of AI and the ethical impacts, especially when we start to consider the military and strategic potential for using autonomous weapons. In fact, I actually have a group that started a little chat on Facebook to try and discuss this. It's called SEAT. That's the Syndicate for the Ethical Application of Technologies. And we're very concerned that these technologies get launched on us without a public discussion of the merits or the problems, you know. So like the academic cheating that's going to take place because of this great launch of ChatGPT, which is it's a very interesting program. I've tried it. It's just the technology tends to lead. And as we know, engineers and designers are all about making products happen quickly now.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have the cultural controls to keep dangerous things away from the culture. And we need a public discussion. So I encourage people to read The Age of AI and Our Human Future.
Chris,
and join us on...
Yes. Oh, sorry. Join you in?
Join us on SEAT.
Yes, yeah. All right, Chris, thank you so much. And turning back to you, Rebecca, when tech leads and ethics and values and a larger discussion are behind the technology, what do you see?
I think this is an excellent point, and I'm really glad that Chris called in. I think there certainly are reasons to be concerned. And we've seen examples of AI-based tools or companies working in this space conducting activities that certainly are very concerning. And, you know, ordinary citizens can sometimes feel like there's relatively little that they can do to kind of stem this tide. And I think, you know, there's very, you know, reasonable concerns about, for instance, these tools being used for widespread surveillance, which is counter to, you know, a lot of our values here in the United States. You know, Chris also mentioned concerns about, for instance, cheating using AI tools. And I think that, you know, that's one example where I'm cautiously more optimistic. I think that it gives us an opportunity to rethink how we evaluate student learning. So for instance, by analogy, when the calculator was introduced, of course, that might make it easier to cheat on different arithmetic tests if we didn't know students were using calculators. But now, you know, we can, there's all different kinds of mathematics beyond arithmetic that we teach students where a calculator is a really useful tool. And we can spend our time focusing on other aspects of mathematics besides the arithmetic operations.
That's really interesting. And I think it folds into something I read yesterday. There was this comment at the end of an article. The person was saying, you know, that their child has dyslexia and the chat bot had provided great scaffolding so the child could then insert their own emotions and thoughts into their writing and into the piece that they were writing, but the scaffolding there was from the chatbot.
Oh, that's an excellent example. I hadn't read that, but that sounds really encouraging and exciting.
I think
it's a balance, right? Chris is very concerned about some of the cultural, social, and ethical impacts, and I think rightfully so. But I think rightfully so concerned about the negative impacts. But I think at the same time, as you're pointing out, there are various positive impacts. So we were talking earlier about healthcare. And I think hopefully some of these tools will make, you know, access to high quality healthcare in underserved regions much better. And so hopefully we can find a good balance here. You know, and another thing that I just wanted to add to that is this Age of AI book that Chris mentioned was co-authored by Eric Schmidt. And Eric Schmidt has recently made a large investment in supporting research in AI and science. And this is another area where I think there's a lot of exciting potential for AI to just facilitate and enhance the scientific discovery process that hopefully is going to lead to a whole host of new scientific discoveries in coming years.
Talking with Rebecca Willett, Faculty Director of AI at the University of Chicago's Data Science Institute. Join in 800-642-1234. Just a bit about the economy here of AI. We're seeing lots of layoffs in the tech sector. Does that affect the future of AI technologies, or does this profession of AI and the development ebb and flow?
Yeah, I would expect there to be an ebb and flow, exactly. But I think also some of the high profile reductions that we've read about are, you know, representing one segment of the AI industry. So, for instance, we were talking about other areas where AI is being used in healthcare context or in defense context and national security, or being used in physics and chemistry and science. And I think these are all areas where we're still seeing a lot of investment and even growth. And so perhaps, you know, the advances that we're making in terms of things like online advertising are not quite as rapid as they were previously. But I think AI in general has still got a lot of potential, and there will remain a number of different job opportunities in the field.
What about people's jobs being replaced due to automation? Is that still so much of a concern?
Yes, I think that there are some jobs that will not require as much human effort as they did previously. There is going to be a change to the economy. But I think that we are going to see a need for new jobs. That there'll be new roles that will emerge as we develop these various AI tools. And so that is going to mean that we'll have to rethink the way that we train students or workers, both, you know, at the university level, perhaps even the K through 12 level, but also as we think about training programs for mid-career professionals. So as we, you know, for instance, see an increase in the uptake and use of AI in various fields, there's going to be a need for learning how to best work with and utilize these tools, how to use them ethically and responsibly, and ensure that we're not doing anything that that
is harmful,
hurts underrepresented.
Sure. I want to pause there. That's okay. Rebecca Willett, University of Chicago. We will pick this up. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The World Economic Forum says AI is an immense opportunity for humankind and many organizations, but questions surface about AI responsibility and trustworthiness and how to leverage data in unbiased ways. Be part of this discussion as we explore where artificial intelligence is headed. Call in with your questions, your comments, anytime, 800-642-1234. Professor Rebecca Willett is Faculty Director of AI at University of Chicago's Data Science Institute. And Ben Zhao is here, Neubauer Professor of Computer Science at University of Chicago. Ben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to go back.
Morning, Becca.
We're going to go back to your AI restaurant reviews to show, you know, to tell us about the risks of computer-generated false information. What did that experiment demonstrate?
Wow. Thanks. You know, it's interesting because that was one of our earlier works in the space. And looking back, it's been 5 years, but it seems like a whole generation since, you know, that work. So that work was about, you know, using the tools of the day at the time to see if we can mimic human written online product reviews and restaurant reviews in order to fool other readers. And one of the things that we proved back in 2017 was that that was possible using rudimentary tools of the day. What's interesting is that, you know, it's only been 5 years-ish, but the AI tools and the machine learning tools generative models have gone so far beyond what we had back then.
ChatGPT could write your restaurant review in a heartbeat now. I mean,
oh, absolutely. It can write entire articles, you know, news articles. And in fact, I think it's been doing that for some news networks, and people are now just being told about it.
What is your impression of this as, you know, this type of tech moves and advances so much in 5 years, and, you know, how that informs you as you look back at your own discoveries as, you know, in the restaurant review study?
Yeah, it's really forcing people to adjust. You know, Becca and me and others like myself, you know, we work in the space on a daily basis, and yet I'm still constantly surprised by just how fast it's moving. Again, in a very similar vein, you know, we had a paper in 2021 December that showed how people can be fooled by generative models that mimic your voice, using your voice to speak certain things that you've never said. And that back then was sort of a surprise, but now there are new tools coming from OpenAI and others that do perfect mimicry of your voice, saying things that you've never said. So again, just leaps and bounds in a matter of months, and it's just really been shocking.
Becca, if we start embedding AI across all these systems, all these types of platforms, what is the potential for something going wrong, for hacks or bad outcomes?
I think left unchecked, these systems do have enormous potential for bad outcomes. But I'm encouraged by the fact that there are whole communities of people who are dedicating their careers and their lives to helping prevent that. Some of it is raising awareness. So when some of these systems are biased or unfair, or you know, giving misleading impressions of small communities, people will raise awareness of those issues and make efforts to think about how to better select the kinds of data that we're using to train these systems. There's also a variety of more technical tools that are being developed. So for instance, imagine a system where you want to collect data from a variety of people's different cell phones and use that data in order to train your machine learning system. So of course, people would rightfully be very concerned about sharing all of their cell phone data with some unknown entity that's going to try to learn from it for, you know, exactly the kinds of reasons that Ben is describing. But there are tools like federated learning, for instance, where the idea is that we figure out how to train these models while protecting the privacy of each individual cell phone user. So we ensure that we aren't somehow sharing the data directly with somebody who might eventually have adversarial intentions, but rather just sharing sort of a representation of your individual cell phone data that protects your privacy, but still allows these models to learn something useful. And so the fact that mathematicians and statisticians and computer scientists are thinking very carefully about how to best protect people, I think, is a really key and important development.
Ben, how do you view security and privacy as you see the technology moving so quickly in the AI space?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, in many ways, it can be alarming. I think as a society, there are segments of different industries that are perhaps more disrupted than others. So segments including, you know, press and journalism, including the law, there are certain aspects of, you know, some of these new tools that are really going to force people to rethink how they do their jobs. So certainly you guys talked already about, you know, people being displaced from employment. That's a very sort of tangible outcome, but there are other less tangible outcomes like, you know, proof of evidence in legal proceedings and people having to sort of retrain themselves to believe less in what they see and hear, because some of these, you know, tangible piece of evidence now can be generated using AI. So there's a lot of these industries where people need to sort of retrain themselves on how to adapt in this new space. A lot of us are working to sort of minimize the damage while we're all shifting towards this new mindset. But yeah, in that you know, sort of time period where we're all shifting and adjusting, there can be a lot of damage done, and hopefully it will not be too disruptive.
ChatGPT had said in this statement, I think, to CBS News that they are already developing a tool to help anyone identify text that is generated by ChatGPT, like a watermark or something. Does that put you at ease at all, Ben?
It's funny. I was just having a conversation over Twitter with some other folks in the space about that particular algorithm. And there's some promising techniques there, probabilistic algorithms to hide some of these things. The trouble is that in this space, in this general space of security and privacy, there's always a sort of cat and mouse game. And in other words, when there are useful techniques, defenses proposed like this, given sufficient incentive, there's always a way to crack it. And no algorithm, whether it's attack or defense, will sort of stand the test of time. So as with many other things, this watermark techniques, and we've had discussions about what that specifics of that algorithm might be, there are ways to get around it. So the question is, what role will this watermark take in sort of broader society? Will this really address traditional sort of sort of non-technical folks and misuse of this in more common mediums, like, you know, school-age kids, for example, using ChatGPT to generate homeworks. I think in those kind of contexts, it'll be great and they will be effective. But in truly sort of mission critical or safety critical circumstances, you cannot rely completely on these kind of defense mechanisms because attackers and adversaries will find a way around them. There, none of these things are foolproof.
We're talking about artificial intelligence with University of Chicago computer scientists Ben Zhao and Rebecca Willett. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Steve in Lake Geneva. Hi, Steve. What is your question?
Yes, hi there. I just got a quick question for your guests, and that is, do you believe the advance of AI will lead to more open source hardware and software solutions and more robust open industry standards across economies, or more closed source, locked down proprietary hardware and software solutions, aka more black boxes? And what would that mean in terms of end user privacy and security, which is really critical for our age? Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Steve. Becca, you go first here.
Yeah, that's a great question, Steve. Thanks for calling in. You know, I think that some of the traditional ways that we've thought about open source hardware and software are perhaps a little different when we think about AI systems. So, for instance, if I'm training a neural network AI system based on training data, we can think about different things that might be open source. One could just be the individual neural network architecture. You know, how many different nodes does it have? What's connected to what? Often those kinds of things are pretty much open. And we know a lot about the individual structures of different networks. Another layer is the actual data that's being used to train these models. And there, sometimes for very good reasons, people try to keep that training data private. And I think that that's good and that will hopefully continue. And then in addition, we can think about what's called the trained model. So once I've got my neural network and I have my training data, I use the training data to basically set the weights or parameters of that neural network. And so once I've done all that hard work, one thing that people might do is just release those learned weights or those learned parameters. And in some cases, people have released those trained models, and it's been extremely helpful for the community because instead of having to start the whole process over from scratch, they can use that as sort of a jumping off point to doing bigger and better things. But in other cases, that can open up security risks. You know, perhaps those learned parameters tell us a little bit of something about the training data without us realizing it, or could really kind of be the competitive edge associated with a company where they want to keep those weights private because they know their competitors don't have the computational resources to figure all that out for themselves.
And at the end of the day, they want to turn a profit. Ben, I want to toss that back to you as you look at proprietary systems, the future of AI, and what should be open and knowledgeable open source.
Yeah. I mean, Becca already covered a lot of it very well. I would just add that I think we're now getting into the stage where some of these models are extremely expensive to produce and train because it actually literally involves getting nearly all the data that we could possibly have, right? Some of these new generational language models are literally trained on everything that is documented. So the costs are ramping up. And what that means is that the investments that's necessary to generate these models are extremely high. So it is increasingly common for these models to become proprietary. And when that happens, research and users just lose more access to some of these different models for testing, for debugging. And so, yeah, I think that's the larger trend. If you look at OpenAI and Microsoft's investments, towards OpenAI, some of these newer, bigger models, they, you know, it's justifiable that they want to keep the proprietary models themselves. But in doing so, it is becoming more of a isolated proprietary environment.
University of Chicago computer science professors Ben Zhao and Rebecca Willett guiding us through the potentials for AI, how to deploy it in a responsible way, what is yielding solutions. Still time for your questions, your comments about artificial intelligence, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how a pair of University of Chicago computer scientists, Rebecca Willett and Ben Zhao, think about artificial intelligence and machine learning today. Call in with your questions about AI. Share how AI is transforming your life or what you think is possible in your field. 800-642-1234. Let's dig a little bit deeper here on bias and the risks of bias, Ben. I mean, we have super powerful computers that seemingly can execute anything, any function, but they lack those human characteristics and the nuances and the values. How do you inject, like, compassion into a computer program?
That is a terrific question. You know, I think one of the things as we start thinking deeply about machine learning bias is that in a way, you know, it's about transparency, obviously, but in a sort of a secondary way as well about transparency, because typically speaking, when you deal with other humans, you understand the existence of bias. You account for it in your mental calculus when you deal with them. And so it is easier to expect certain types of bias from certain people. For machine learning, one of the troublesome things about it is that it does have bias. There's embedded bias inside that's almost impossible to get rid of, only minimize. But at the same time, it is not obvious that it is there. And that is part of the challenge. And so part of the issue with dealing with bias may be just getting people more aware that machine learning itself is in many ways like people. It has its own bias because a lot of its training data comes from data generated by people. So it is a product of society and culture and what we do. So it has that carried in bias. And if we can understand that, that will help us deal with and accustomize ourselves to some of that bias and its impact.
Becca, bias, certainly in the healthcare setting too, can have huge implications. How do you see it, you know, to minimize and contain it, as Ben said, especially in that setting of healthcare?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And it is a concern. So we might, for instance, want to use electronic health records to try to identify maybe risk factors for different diseases that we hadn't known about before, or identify best practices for the treatment of different conditions. But unfortunately, we can't think about that data as all being somehow equal or totally independent. So in particular, if our health records represent different populations who are being treated at different clinics, and those clinics have different levels of resources, then we might see correlations that really have nothing to do with best practices, but rather people just doing the best that they can under difficult circumstances. And so we might see certain groups being treated for something like asthma one way and another group being treated for asthma another way. And that might be correlated with something like race, but not be because, you know, there's better treatments for one race than another, but rather because it's a reflection of different groups going to different clinics. And so figuring out how to untangle all of that is a huge issue. And there's a, you know, growing number of people who are thinking carefully about that. Some people are thinking about, how do we actually take AI methods, which largely are kind of focused on finding patterns and in data and translating that into modes where we're focusing on uncovering causal structures. So not just noting that, you know, people with asthma tend to live in, you know, certain zip codes, but actually trying to understand more about the underlying mechanisms that cause people to have higher risk of asthma. This is related to something that some of Ben's and my colleagues at University of Chicago are looking at, called trying to understand the socioome. So what they would say is that when we're trying to understand disease, of course, we know that a lot of that depends on biological mechanisms. But in addition, there are social and environmental and behavioral and psychological factors that all play a big role. Mm-hmm. And this is what they call the socioome. And so what we'd like to do is to figure out how to use AI to better understand those roles. But the challenge is related deeply to these issues of fairness and bias that you're raising. So the data that we have collected about these socioome factors is not nearly as comprehensive. It can reflect the human biases that Ben was talking about, or resource inequities that I was mentioning earlier.
I just want to jump in here, and Ben, you might have the last word here, but in our everyday lives, how do you keep a healthy skepticism about what goes past your eyeballs or what you see or take in as you think about trustworthiness and security and misinformation in these chatbots?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think moving forward, we really have to develop new mental tools for dealing with some of this. So for example, a common attack that has for a long time been carried out by bad actors is sort of the phishing scam, where, mm-hmm. you know, a particularly elderly person might be at home, they get a phone call, claiming, or a text message even, claiming to be one of their young relatives, let's say a grandchild, for example, stranded across the border in some other country, asking him or her, the elder person, to quickly send money to help. And this is sort of an age-old scam that today, with all the tools that are now being created, will carry on some additional weight, right? Now you can imagine actually having a Zoom call come in or a FaceTime call come in, and it looks like your granddaughter or grandson, they're speaking to you in their own voice, asking you to please help me. I'm really stranded in this tough situation. And so, you know, how do we deal with that? I think, you know, we had to really train people, all of us, to sort of understand what is now capable with these tools, and then to actually build in some of these mechanisms to figure out how do we circumvent these attackers that probably are gearing up as we speak.
So
new
much
mental ideas, like, you know, share secrets, a challenge question that you can ask your family or relatives just to verify that it's them and not just believe what you see.
We are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Rebecca Willett, Ben Zhao, both computer scientists at the University of Chicago. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.